Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, November 23rd. OHS grad loving foreign asset program. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. As a youngster, Elijah Barrera always was working on cars. The 22-year-old Odessa High School graduate was able to do that because his father, now retired, owned a body shop. Quote, "But I wanted to learn the mechanic side, so that's why I'm doing this," Barrera said. Now, Barrera is one of nine students in Odessa College's Ford Asset Program, where students learn how to become Ford vehicle technicians. Jennifer Myers, Dean of the School of Business and Industry at OC, said students are selected for the program and they must be sponsored by a Ford dealership. Students are mentored as they're learning, but the expectations are high. Quote, "They actually have to interview with the dealership, so they go in, and of course our instructor, Timothy Roberts, who teaches the asset program, helps facilitate setting up the interview. But really, it's all on the student. They go in, they have to dress appropriately. They do have to interview, so they actually have to be hired by the dealership because they're going to be expected to be able to do the same things the technicians can do," Meyer said. In Barrera's case, he's stationed at Sewell Ford at Parks Legato. Dealerships in Andrews and Midland also are participating. Students must have a clean driving record, undergo a drug screening, and a background check, Meyer said. Overall, the program runs for 2 years, and courses have to be taken in a strict order. Quote, "The students come to us for 8 weeks. They take a couple of academic classes with us, so they learn they might be studying breaks. What's great about this program is that they're with us for 8 weeks, learning skills to work on the vehicles, but then they go to their coupe, what we call a coupe, and they actually work in the dealership with a mentor technician and get to apply the skills they learn in the classroom in the dealership," Meyer said. Students graduate with an Associate in Applied Science degree, but they also do Ford-specific coursework, which gives them Ford certification, she said. Ford ASSET stands for Automotive Student Service Educational Training. Barrera said he saw the new Sewell location at Parks Legato when he was growing up and knew he wanted to work there when he got older. Quote, "I'm here now, and I love it," Barrera said. Before going into the program, Barrera said he was a flatbed truck driver. Quote, "I had applied as an apprentice about a year and a half ago, and then Sewell recruiter Hanna Rajev called me back in March or February. I was actually on the road. She told me about the asset program, so I thought that it would be a good opportunity to start here and work for Sewell Ford," he said. Barrera said he started August 22nd and just got through his first 8 weeks. This is his fourth week in the coupe. He will graduate in May 2022. Quote, "I really just love being part of this team, and I think it's the first place that I can actually say I like coming to work. I look forward to it," Barrera said. He also appreciates the respect Colin Sewell has in the area and how everybody knows him. Quote, "I just knew I wanted to be part of this team, and this is where I wanted to be for my career," Barrera said. Barrera said he is usually with his mentor, John Horn, and doesn't see much of his co-workers. Quote, "He's a really good teacher. He works really hard, and he shows me everything that I need to know and makes sure that I understand everything that I'm doing and how I'm doing it," Barrera said of Horn. He makes sure that I'm responsible with everything, that I just try to minimize mistakes and work efficiently. He's a really good mentor to me. He's shown me a lot. I've already learned much more than what I did before I got in the program just by being with him the first month that I was here before starting school." End quote. Razieff said she's been able to compare the Forward Asset Program at OC with other programs because she recruits from many different technical schools and other community colleges. Quote, "I was very glad that we finally have something local, so instead of having to recruit from Houston or Dallas or New Mexico, I'm now able to say we found someone local that we like, that's already here with our team, and we could just send them to training," she said. "It's 10 minutes away instead of having to send them across the state or across the border. I think it's going to be great as the years go on. We're going to get more and more opportunities to train people because we do have a good amount of entry-level technicians that are interested. It's just finding those guys that are local and committed to a career choice," Razieff said. Like Razieff, Pereira says he thinks the main benefit of the program is that it's local. Quote, "Because honestly, if it were somewhere else, I don't know if I'd be able to do it just because of how I had to take care of family and stuff like that. But it is here in the Odessa Midland area, so we can probably get a lot of guys that are from this area instead of having to recruit from elsewhere," Pereira said. He added that if anyone is interested in the field, he would recommend joining the Forward Asset Program. Meyer said there are 5 students at Sewell Ford, and the remaining 4 are in Andrews and Midland. Quote, "Mr. Sewell and the Sewell family have just been a great partner for us, and they really want to give students the opportunity," Meyer said, "and they need more technicians. Everyone's cars are still breaking down despite COVID, so there is still a demand for technicians," end quote. Other automakers like Toyota and Honda have similar programs. Quote, "Our plan is to expand, obviously, but Ford, because of the great support we've gotten from Mr. Sewell and his family and that dealership, Ford was kind of the no-brainer to start. It's really going to be kind of the example that is set for other programs that follow," Meyer said. There is also a generic automotive and diesel pathway. Quote, "It just depends on what type of vehicles you want to work on. Our diesel pathway teaches you how to work on the heavy trucks, buses, the large vehicles. Then your automotive pathway is your standard what you see everyone driving on the road," Meyer said. The Ford Asset Program has been in the works since mid-2017 because you have to go through a lot of work with Ford Corporate and you have to get ASE accreditation, she said. Sewell Auto Tech opened in January 2020 for students and the grand opening was in February. Along with Roberts, who had been the instructor at New Mexico Junior College in Hobbs, New Mexico, there will be another who is working on his credentials, Meyer said. Razieff said Sewell is always open to meeting anyone who is interested in becoming a technician. Quote, "We do have scholarships available for the program. It's a very affordable and sometimes free option to become a technician, and you get hands-on experience," she said. Myers added that something she would want parents to know is that it's a great career, quote, "and you can make a lot of money," end quote. Making history. STEM seniors part of school history. Editor's note. This is the first in an occasional series following a member of the first STEM Academy senior class. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. When May rolls around, Ty Sykes will be in select company. Sykes, who is 17, is one of about 50 members of the first class of seniors at the University of Texas Permian Basin STEM Academy. The public charter school is on the UTPB campus. Students can take dual credit courses from UTPB. Sykes began attending STEM Academy in sixth grade. Quote, "It definitely feels different from how other people describe their high school experiences, in a good way," he said. "It's more special because at Permian, you're probably like the 50th graduating class or more, but here, you're the first. My brother's in the fifth grade. He's going to be like my brother was the first graduating class," end quote. Sykes wants to be a mechanical engineer when he gets older. Quote, "I've always liked building things. It wasn't until I came here and we started doing more hands-on stuff that I started liking it more. It was kind of an afterthought. I've always been kind of good at math. I've always kind of liked math. Then I figured I'm good at building things, so I thought it would be a good career for me," end quote. STEM Academy principal Cody Griffin said Sykes has been working on mechanical engineering projects, such as robotics, since he arrived at the school, and he's been part of the internship program. Quote, "So he's gotten a wide variety of experience," Griffin said. Last year, Sykes said he interned at RefChem Engineering and Construction Services. Quote, "They mainly work on oil plants and separation plants," Sykes said. Griffin said he learned to read RefChem's drawings and do estimates. This year, Sykes is a host at Cork and Pig Tavern. He said he has enjoyed the STEM Academy because of its experiential approach. Quote, "It's more involved and has smaller classes. The teachers know you. The teachers know when you need help, and everybody knows everybody, so you can ask a friend for help if they're in the same classes as you, and it's not weird. The days are kind of short sometimes, too," Sykes said. Sykes said he wants to earn his bachelor's degree at UTPB and then move on to a larger college for his master's, quote, "so I can make more money," end quote. On a visit to the College of Engineering, Griffin said George Nana, the dean, talked to students about paying for their first two engineering classes. Griffin said Sykes is taking a dual credit engineering class this year, quote, "so that was really a plus for him because of all of his dual credit classes. Then when he goes into that meta major, which is basically where he's going now with the university, as he starts working with them, some of those classes are going to get paid for by the engineering department at UTPB," Griffin said. Sykes said it's kind of a relief having some of the expense taken care of. He's also impressed with the engineering building located near the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center in Midland County. Quote, "It's really cool. They have a lot of new stuff in there. We were working in the computer lab, and the computer is really up to date. I saw a couple of the engineering labs, which has cool equipment that I don't know how to use," Sykes said. The chairs of each division in the College of Engineering presented to STEM students during their visit, so Sykes got to meet them, but it was just a quick introduction, Griffin said. He has had a head start working with some of the software that he would be using in college, so he said he feels like he has a good foundation. Speaking of foundation, Sykes says he's always been interested in building things. Quote, "I don't quite remember when I started getting interested in it, but it's just always been there. We started robotics, and I got an insight into what it's like. This was before I had ever really built anything. I just looked at it and thought it was cool. When I actually started doing it, I found it was a lot more fun," Sykes said. Griffin said Sykes' forte on the robotics team was building. Sykes said he likes to look at cars and see how they work, but bridges generally look the same to him. Griffin said Sykes and his classmates are fortunate to be in a setting where they are able to take advantage of some of the engineering work that Nana has offered, and they are meeting with the Dean of the College of Health Sciences and Human Performance, Donna Buch, because some STEM students are on the biomedical science track. Buch was previously the Dean of the College of Nursing, which is now under the new college. Quote, "We're trying to really work with them to give them an academic experience, but also a high school experience, so it's just that balance of a typical high school experience and then a unique experience that is STEM. Because of our setting and our partnership with the university, we've really tried to focus in on our internships this year, but it's been difficult to form partnerships because of COVID-19, Griffin said. Last year, STEM Academy was able to partner with the city of Odessa and have students work in all the engineering departments. There were also students who worked in the city health clinic. This year, the city has had to pull back because of COVID precautions. Sykes said being at STEM on a university campus is different from what he'd imagine a regular high school is like, which he guesses is kind of large and intimidating. Quote, "I'm not a very social person. Talking to people is not my forte, but being here gives me experience of what it looks like to be a college student. I've seen the dorms. I've seen the dining hall. I've been to the chemistry labs, and I've seen what those look like. Then I've been to all the lecture halls at the engineering and the university campus. I went to the police department to get my parking permit, so I know what it's like to get my parking permit," Sykes said. Quick Hits, bilingual series. The Solros Theater Program has scheduled the opening of Tenemos Todo, We Had Everything, a collaboration between professional playwrights and Solros Theater students. Tenemos Todo, We Had Everything, is an original bilingual series of short scenes and monologues about Texans and the way they are coping with the new normal of life during a pandemic. Tenemos Todo, We Had Everything, will be released on streaming platforms beginning Tuesday. For more information, visit www.solros.edu/theater or follow the Solros Theater Program on Facebook and Instagram. The Humane Society of Odessa, 7012 Mockingbird Lane, is in need of cold weather donations for its current pet residents. What is needed are blankets, new or used, pillows, pillowcases, towels, dish towels or rags, sheets, comforters, dog and cat beds, rugs, carpets, and turf. Donations may be dropped off anytime at the shelter or call 432-257-4311 to schedule a large load pickup. Visit www.facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Editor's note: Ector County will not be able to update the COVID-19 dashboard this week due to limited data entry staff. Texas, 1,094,275 confirmed cases with 9,991,420 tested. Total Texas deaths, 20,556. U.S. cases, 12,028,081 total confirmed cases and 255,076 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC website at tinyurl.com/tztrjlf. Family Caregivers Month. This is a guest column written by Carol Cates, the Chief Nursing Officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. My stepmom decided, along with my dad and the rest of the family, to go on hospice last week. She has been in poor health for quite a while now and has reached the point where hospice is the best option for her in terms of quality of life versus quantity of life. Hospice is such a gift in those times, and while it was difficult to make that decision, I am so glad we did. My dad and my stepsister take care of her at home, and it is more than a full-time job. She needs help with everything from bathing to going to the bathroom to eating. At night, someone must stay awake because she often wakes up confused, gets out of bed, and falls. She's broken her hip, her wrist, and several ribs, and had far too many bruises and scrapes to count on the first couple of years because she gets out of bed in the middle of the night, despite everything we've done to try and prevent it. For all of us in the family, family caregiving is a never-ending worry. And it's not just hard on us, it's hard on my stepmom because she feels like she's being treated like a child, not the independent adult she has earned the right to be. Hospice has made a difference for them already with the additional help at home, especially at night, but the job of family caregiving is still there, and it's a big job. For many reasons, not everyone can get additional help like hospice has provided my parents. Added to that, for many families, the caregivers are also working and often taking care of other members of the family like small children. Those things take a big job even with help and make it huge. Family caregiving is a big challenge for anyone who takes on that responsibility. November is Family Caregivers Month, a time for us to recognize the wonderful people who take on the difficult task of caring for an adult in their family. Some interesting statistics about family caregivers. The number of family caregivers is increasing rapidly. In 2015, there were 43 million family caregivers in the U.S. That number is up to 53 million in 2020. That works out to 1 in 5 people in the U.S. are taking care of an adult family member in their homes. 24% of family caregivers take care of more than one family member at home. The most common reason people need care from family members at home is Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Most family caregivers are women. 1 in 4 family caregivers report that caring for a loved one has not improved their relationships within the family, but instead has disrupted those relationships. Most family caregivers also have full-time jobs. Over 11 million people, known as the sandwich caregivers, take care of both adults and children at home. Over 1 million young people, aged 18 or less, are the caregiver for an adult in their family. 70% of family caregivers say they don't visit a doctor regularly or pay attention to their own health because of the time it takes away from caring for their family member. 21% report their own health is fair to poor. 45% of family caregivers state that caring for a family member at home has created serious financial problems in the home. Those numbers really show how big the job is and how much the strain it can put on the caregiver. If you are a family caregiver, thank you for the sacrifices you make to take care of another person. You are doing something that defines the phrase labor of love. I know you don't get thanked enough. Please know you are very appreciated. Please remember you are not in this alone. There are resources out there to help you with support, advice on how to deal with the issues that caregivers face, and ways you can take care of yourself. The National Alliance for Caregiving, NAC, has many great resources for caregivers on their website, www.caregiving.org. Caregiving alone is hard enough, but this year we also have the burden of COVID-19. And those who are being cared for are more likely falling into the high-risk population. That adds one more weight on the shoulders of those family caregivers. If you know someone who is a family caregiver, make sure you let them know how wonderful they are. Help them stay safe during this difficult time, if you can, by helping them to practice social distancing, avoiding crowds, and staying away when you have any symptoms of an illness. You can do that by running errands, bringing by meals, and being available to talk by phone or on a virtual forum like Skype or FaceTime. As always, please stay safe, wear a mask, social distance, and wash your hands frequently. Diabetes eats away at health. This is a guest column from Carol Cates, who is the chief nursing officer at Odessa Regional Medical Center. I think after a while in nursing, most of us end up with a list of health conditions we pray we never get. For me, that list seems to keep getting longer, but the two things that have been at the very top of that list for me for years are dementia and diabetes. Dementia, because it is so hard on not just the person, but because in many ways it's even harder on their family. Diabetes, because it just slowly eats away at a person's health when it is uncontrolled. There isn't a single system in the body that is not affected by diabetes in some way when it is not controlled. Keeping it under control is a day-to-day challenge for most people. I live with a diabetic, and that is his biggest struggle, living with the restrictions that are required to keep that condition under control every day. Diabetes doesn't care that it's Christmas, Thanksgiving, or a birthday, and that person wants an extra piece of cake. Diabetes doesn't care that a person just doesn't feel like exercising today. And worst, those restrictions are for life, because there is no cure for diabetes. November is American Diabetes Month, a time set aside to raise awareness about diabetes. What it is, how we can prevent it or minimize its impact, and how we can support the search for a cure. Diabetes is a group of several conditions. In all of them, there is an issue with the body's ability to move glucose into cells using insulin. Glucose is the sugar that our body uses for fuel at the cellular level. Insulin is a chemical produced by specialized cells in the pancreas called beta cells. Insulin acts kind of like a key that opens a doorway into the cell that allows glucose to enter the cell from the bloodstream. That is a very simple explanation of something very complex, but I hope it gives you an idea of the basics with diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, the body can no longer make insulin. People with type 1 diabetes must take insulin every single day, sometimes multiple times a day. Insulin is really fragile, so it can't survive in the stomach or intestines, which means it can't be taken as a pill. That means the only way to reliably take insulin is by injection, which means people use an insulin pump, which injects tiny amounts of insulin at frequent intervals through a needle that stays in the skin for a few days, or they give themselves insulin shots. There has been some success with inhaled insulin, but it doesn't work for everyone. Type 2 diabetes is the most common type. Type 2 diabetes is also the one that is most preventable. In type 2 diabetes, the body doesn't use insulin properly. With type 2 diabetes, diet is the biggest key to managing the condition. Some people can control their type 2 diabetes with insulin alone, but others need medications and sometimes insulin as well. Gestational diabetes is when a woman becomes diabetic while they are pregnant. It does not mean they will be diabetic once the baby is born, but but can mean they do have a higher risk for type 2 diabetes in the long term. There are other types of diabetes that are much rarer, like neonatal diabetes, diseases of the pancreas that affect the beta cells, like pancreatitis, and drug or chemical-induced diabetes. Those are all treated similarly to either type 1 or type 2 diabetes, depending on if the person is making insulin or not. If you are at risk for type 2 diabetes, you can delay or even prevent the onset of diabetes. The American Diabetes Association has a 60-second type 2 diabetes risk test on their website at www.diabetes.org to help you determine your risk of type 2 diabetes, and great resources to help you control your risk of diabetes and hopefully prevent that condition. While diabetes is a challenge, there is also a great deal of good news with diabetes right now. The Endocrine Society says that while the cure to diabetes is still in the distant future, there is research going on that is showing promise in finding a cure. Most of those are genetic therapies that allow the body to replace the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. The medications and technology that we have now are also light years ahead of where we were just a few years ago in terms of making diabetes easier to manage. For instance, there are insulin pumps that constantly monitor someone's blood sugar and adjust their insulin levels accordingly, so people with type 1 diabetes don't have to frequently stick their fingers to check their blood sugars and give themselves multiple shots every day. The meds for type 2 diabetes are better as well. They help control blood sugars better for longer periods of time between doses and cause much fewer side effects. Those things mean it keeps getting easier for people to keep diabetes under control and avoid the long-term problems diabetes causes. The American Diabetes Association website, www.diabetes.org, is a great resource if you want more information about diabetes, what it is, your risk factors, and how to take care of yourself if you have diabetes or are at risk for diabetes.
Hi, this is Bailey reading the death notices from the Odessa American for Monday, November 23rd, 2020. Jerry Eldon Barfield, 77, of Odessa, died Monday, November 16th, 2020, in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Carol Joyce Britton Wagner, 78, of Odessa, died Friday, November 20th, in Odessa. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Frank W. Wilson, Funeral Directors of Odessa. Anna Maria Martinez Zaragoza, 65, of Odessa, died Monday, November 9th, in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at Tuesday at 2 p.m., November 24th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Father Bernard is officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hello, this is Cindy. Our city will respond to the message of the crisis. Patrick Payton, Midland Mayor. Editor's note. The following are the comments made by Mayor Patrick Payton prior to the vote on the mask ordinance that the Midland City Council voted down Tuesday. I felt it was important for Midlanders to read his words about the ordinance and why it was necessary. Stuart Doreen, Editor. Since the weekend of March 13th, 2020, each and every one of us have been dealing with COVID-19 and the undeniable and unprecedented repercussions it has had on us at every level of life. Every sector of our city and every facet of our lives has been adversely affected. Perhaps no area has been as adversely affected as our concept of how to govern and lead, when matters of such an unprecedented reach press upon our founding principles, our ideals, and accountable measures. In the early days and weeks of this pandemic, I issued and Council ratified an emergency declaration that gave me far-reaching authority in how to respond during these days. That type of declaration was at once necessary but equally as dangerous, which is why I allowed it to lapse as soon as possible. During the intervening months of spring 2020 and the issues and challenges we have faced due to COVID-19, our city has resisted the urge to seize executive power by mandate and fiat to combat this virus. We have repeatedly called on citizens of this city to look out for themselves and for their neighbors, and contrary to certain comments, they have responded with typical West Texas fervor when the message has been clear. At the same time, I have repeatedly voiced my frustration with state leadership that 9 months into the greatest health challenge we have faced in a generation or possibly two, the very principles and foundation of representative governance have been abandoned at the state level in the refusal to call a special session of the people's legislature to deal with this health crisis. Our own governor has said, not all of Texas is affected the same, which begs the question, then why treat all of Texas the same rather than bring Texas together in the form of their elected representatives and debate responses, solutions, and actions? I have not wavered from this message and will not waver from this message. Which brings me to the point of this exercise we have been involved with since the middle of last week and culminating in today's council discussion, excellent debate, and pending decision or decisions on how to handle this. For weeks now, I have heard many voices urge me to issue a mask mandate. I repeat, urge me to issue a mask mandate. None of those voices have asked the council to debate and issue a mandate. Not the council's fault. It is sliding from governing principles. To be clear, some voices have asked us to enforce the governor's mandate, but some of those very same voices that urge us to enforce the governor's mandate tell me not to enforce a local business mandate. Interesting in the least, as both requests require we still deal with the nature of enforcement. In my efforts to practice my belief in the principles of representative governance, especially in critical and prolonged periods of national, state, and local import, I placed a possible ordinance on the agenda, which is on the agenda today if you have missed this meeting, for us as a representative body to debate, discuss, and decide. Unlike voices that have grown comfortable with the language of unilateral, mayoral, and gubernatorial action, I am not comfortable with such mandates and actions, and I made the decision to put the issue to an up or down debate and vote by the elected representatives of this city and not just one person, the mayor, which is why I'm so thankful for the other issues that have been brought up. Councilman Trost, your plan you submitted, Councilman Norman, your thoughts, Councilman Ladd, Councilman Robnett, who in the next 24 hours, if we get to the consent agenda, he will have some other things to represent to us as well. By placing this item on the agenda, a couple of things have finally been made clear. The foundational principle of elected representatives all being spoken to via email and social media has eclipsed the unhealthy nature of a tilt toward acceptance of unilateral mandates by one elected official. 2. Though some would like to argue a difference, the reality is clearly more simple. Whether it is a business mandate or a governor's mandate to wear masks, the enforcement of these measures has proven not only elusive, but impossible throughout the nation. All you have to do is observe the entire nation has been as draconian as anywhere can be from coast to coast, and everyone is dealing with this again. Just for a minute, about the mass ticketing and arrests of Americans due to mask violations. The principles are rare because it cannot be enforced. Some might ask, Why put this on the agenda if you were not going to support it? The answer is simple if you haven't discerned it by now. We, as your elected representatives, wanted to hear from you, those who we represent, and we would debate, we would discuss, and we would vote as elected officials and not from a unilateral mandate. In a multitude of voices is where a better answer comes at this time. If we enforced the governor's order, we would have Midlanders calling 911 on Midlanders, and I'm afraid to say that even in this conversation, we seem to have possibly grown comfortable with that. And eventually we will pit one against the other. I've already had people tell me we should set up a mask patrol unit. That actually came from a physician, to seek out and find violators. I hope the Orwellian nature of such an idea strikes fear in all of you. If we enforce making businesses demand of their patrons to wear masks or face a fine of $500, we have created a secret code of patrons who won't report violators, and we encourage patrons to call the mask unit out to track down businesses that are violating orders. I, for one, believe, and I am at fault for not sounding the alarm as boldly recently, our city will respond to the message of the crisis. They will react to the message of Orwellian dictates. Either way, this issue gets placed into practice. It is unreasonable and unenforceable, and ultimately as dangerous as the health and welfare of the community that now more than ever needs to be united in our efforts and not divided by well-meaning but impossible mandates. My message has remained the same and will remain the same, regardless of how council votes. The residents of Midland have heard the message, and they are actually hearing the message more now than they've ever heard before. COVID-19 is here. It is a real, and we must fight against it. We must honor and serve one another's health and safety, as well as the sacrifice of our healthcare community that no one minimizes and no one discounts. We are calling on this community to practice social distancing. We're calling on this community to wear a mask. I can only imagine the emails I will get because I had my mask up or down because of how aggressive and out of control this discussion has become. When you can't also social distance indoors, wear your mask. Be careful with family. Practice excellent personal hygiene and disinfecting. We must fight through this without resorting to unconstitutional and unrepresented mandates and dictates and counsel. I cannot be more proud that any other time that of all the things we faced, you have come ready to debate, ready to discuss, and even to compromise for us to get to even better answers along the path. Midlanders Company creates two new ranch water flavors by J.C. Lewis. Lone River Ranch Water has released two new flavors in time for the holiday season. Spicy Ranch Water and Rio Red Grapefruit Ranch Water are on grocery store and liquor store shelves now. Lone River's Spicy Ranch Water is the original ranch water recipe with a Texas kick. The West Texas Cocktail Classic is made with 100% organic agave, natural lime juice, and a hint of jalapeno. The Rio Red Grapefruit Ranch Water offers a different flavor profile with a Texas-sized squeeze of Rio Red Grapefruit Juice, 100% organic agave, and natural lime. Lone River Ranch Water was created by Midlander Katie Beal Brown, CEO of Lone River Beverage Company. The ranch water seltzer is part of Brown's family gatherings and culture, she said in a previous MRT article. Brown said she started the company as a way to help tell the story of West Texas and its relationship to ranch water, which is a hard seltzer. All Lone River Ranch Water varieties, sold in a six-pack with a suggested retail price, $8.99, are available statewide at major retailers such as HEB, United Supermarkets, 7-Eleven, and independent stores throughout the state. For more information, visit LoneRiverBevCo.com. Walk-ons to open today. Walk-ons Sports Bistro, 4605 Whitman Drive, is having its grand opening today. The first 20 customers will receive a mini football autographed by Drew Brees, quarterback of the New Orleans Saints and the chain's co-owner. In addition, guests can enter a drawing for a chance to win free walk-ons for a year. Entries will be accepted during the Midland Restaurant's first full month of business. The winner will be announced the week of December 21st. Walk-ons, known for a Louisiana-inspired menu and game day atmosphere, will be open 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Sunday through Thursday and 11 a.m. to midnight Friday and Saturday. The restaurant's opening will kick off at 11 a.m. with a ribbon cutting by the Midland Chamber of Commerce. Restaurants open on Thanksgiving. Curbside Bistro at 3816 Andrews Highway in Odessa will be open from 11 a.m. to when food runs out. The lunch is free to anyone needing assistance. Cracker Barrel Old Country Store will be open 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. at 3108 North Loop 250 West. IHOP will be open on Thanksgiving with special pumpkin spice pancakes available. The restaurant's two locations are open 24 hours, 7 days a week. Saltgrass will be open for a dine-in turkey dinner from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 4511 Loop 250 Frontage Road. Buffalo Wild Wings will be open 3 p.m. to 2 a.m. at 5107 West Wadley Avenue. Carino's will be open noon to 6 p.m. at 711 Loop 250 Frontage Road. Starbucks locations will be open 4:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Whataburger open Thursday for 24 hours. Twins are divided over mom's treatment for terminal cancer. Dear Abby, for Monday. Dear Abby, my 63-year-old mother has recently been diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic lung cancer. Even prior to her diagnosis, she was a negative and depressed person. She's been a smoker, drinker, and backseat driver for almost 50 years. She has undergone intense radiation, but is refusing to take her chemo pill. In her words, why should she prolong her life by another year, especially if it causes more side effects and won't cure her? My twin and I are her only children. She has no significant life partner and there are no grandkids. While I have kept in steady contact and maintained relations with her, even during all our bad times, my brother has taken an out-of-sight, out-of-mind attitude. We both live a 2 or 3 hour distance away from Mom. The problem now is, my brother wants her to persevere through all the doctor's treatments, while I have accepted her decision to essentially let go. How can I help him come to terms with Mom's decision? And do you recommend any resources? Son, brother in California. Dear son, brother, I firmly believe in a person's right to make their own decision when it comes to continuing or discontinuing treatment for a terminal illness. If your mother feels the chemotherapy has side effects that are too debilitating to tolerate, it should be her choice whether to discontinue them rather than the preference of your brother. If your mother prefers palliative or hospice care, she is entitled to have it and she should discuss it with her doctor, who can see that she receives it. Two excellent books will provide the information you are seeking and more. Read them and share them with your brother. Both include the topic of physician-assisted aid in dying. The first, titled Finish Strong, is written by Barbara Coombs Lee, the founder of Compassion and Choices, an organization to which I have been a longtime contributor. For free resources regarding your mom's decision, visit CompassionandChoices.org. The second book, authored by Diane Rehm, who hosted the Diane Rehm Show on NPR from 1979 to 2016, is titled When My Time Comes, and will be followed by a documentary to be aired in the spring of 2021 on PBS. Dear Abby, I have been happily married for a few years. Prior to getting engaged, I had a close friend I had feelings for, but nothing ever came of it. We have remained close and see each other throughout the year at work conferences. He lives in a nearby town. I have realized the feelings I have had for him over the years haven't gone away. Should I tell him how I feel or forever keep my peace? History repeating in Alabama. Dear History, history isn't repeating itself. It's the same old story playing in your head. Ask yourself what you have to gain by telling him you still have romantic feelings for him. If the answer is trouble in your happy marriage, then keep your trap shut. Write Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California 90069. Book takes a look at George H.W. Bush by Michael Bauer. George H.W. Bush lived in a lot of different places in his lifetime. The 41st president was born in Milton, Massachusetts, raised in Greenwich, Connecticut, and eventually made his way south to the Lone Star State. While Bush was widely hailed from Houston, his time spent in the Permian Basin area is something that played an important part in his life, according to author Charles Denyer. Denyer discusses Bush's time in West Texas with a biography titled Texas Titans, George H.W. Bush and James A. Baker III, A Friendship Forged in Power. The book, which talks about Bush's relationship with one of his closest friends and right-hand man, James Baker, will be released next month. Denyer, who lives in Austin, says that West Texas is where it all started for Bush and his family. Well, if you think about it, here's a man who came in from the East Coast and arrives with a unique vernacular, Denyer said. Cowboy boots, barbecue, and everything that was Texan was so foreign to him. West Texas truly was a whole new country for Bush. After graduating from Yale in 1948, Bush and his family moved to Odessa. He was transferred to Compton, California for a short time in 1949, before the family moved back to West Texas in 1950, to Midland. Coming in from the East Coast wasn't easy for Bush and his wife Barbara. However, Denyer said, the people in the Permian Basin embraced them and believed in them. He became a true Texan, not so much through Houston, but it started the Odessa-Midland area, Denyer said. Bush started off working as an oil field equipment salesman for Dresser Industries. In 1951, Bush and John Overby launched the Bush Overby Oil Development Company. In 1953, he co-founded the Zapata Petroleum Corporation. While living in the Permian Basin, the Bushes raised their family, including 43rd President George W. Bush, who was born in New Haven, Connecticut, in 1946, but attended public schools in Midland. Their sons John, Jeb, Neil, and Marvin were born in Midland. Their daughter Robin was born in California. In 1954, he was named president of the Zapata Offshore Company, which was a subsidiary that specialized in offshore drilling. In Denyer's book, he explained that Bush proclaimed 1954 to be a good year for Zapata, with the company holding a one-third interest in 70 wells and 100 more wells to drill in 1955. It wasn't until 1959 when the subsidiary became independent and Bush moved his family from Midland to Houston. Dorothy was born in Houston shortly after the transition. After becoming well acclimated in West Texas, Denyer explained that it wasn't an easy decision for the future president to pick up his family and move again, but that Bush knew what had to be done. Well, he was very comfortable in the Permian Basin, Denyer said, but he knew that he needed to be closer to the Gulf. So I think, personally, he agonized over it because he had been so accustomed to life in the Permian Basin. But he felt that he wanted to grow, and he wanted to grow his offshore company, and to do that he had to go to Houston. A passage from the book detailed Bush loved his life in Midland, but he acknowledged years later that Midland is nowhere near the Gulf of Mexico, where all our drilling rigs were operating. The rest is history. Bush would eventually venture into politics, serving as vice president under Ronald Reagan, before being elected president in 1988. His time as president saw a changing world, which included the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and the end of the Cold War, as well as the Persian Gulf War, just to name a few. I don't know of any other president in modern time that's been faced with such a cascade of events over 48 months, Denyer said. Those events completely changed the world. All the events were absolutely monumental and consequential. Bush handled them, I think, with the utmost expertise that you would ever find with any commander-in-chief. As Denyer discusses in his book, Baker was by Bush's side throughout all of the events that transpired during his single term in office as commander-in-chief. Baker was heavily involved in the many policy decisions that the United States would ultimately take, Denyer said. The Berlin Wall, the fall of communism, Baker was there by Bush's side and helped make decisions that would help impact the entire world. However, Bush's time in Odessa, Midland, is something that shouldn't be overlooked, Denyer said. What he found in Odessa and Midland were normal people, and I think that really resonated with him, Denyer said. I think it set the tone for who he was as a human being. He was a normal person and humble. A lot of those traits were ingrained in him when he moved to Odessa. Texas Titans will be available in hardcover, paperback, and ebook formats wherever books are sold on November 17th. Father-in-law expects future grandchildren to be Catholic. Dear Abby for Friday. Dear Abby, my husband and I are trying to have children. He was raised Catholic, but is now agnostic. I am also agnostic. My deeply religious father-in-law insists that our four children be baptized Catholic. I'm against it because I think it should be a person's right to choose which faith, if any, to follow when they are ready. I also think it would be hypocritical to go through a baptismal ceremony with godparents and vows to raise our child a certain way when we have no intention of doing it. My husband thinks it would be best to baptize our future children to keep the peace, because his father will never forgive us if we don't. I think it's our children, our lives, our ethics. Which of us is right? Out in the open. Dear Out, you are, but I don't envy what's ahead for you. If you knuckle under your father-in-law, it won't stop. You will be expected to follow through with a Catholic upbringing, First Communion, Catholic schools, church attendance for the children, and everything that comes with it. You and your husband should bite the bullet, be up front with his dad before you become pregnant, and make plain how you plan to raise your children. If you aren't, raising them in a way you don't want could put a strain on your marriage. This should be your and your husband's decision to make and no one else's, and I don't recommend deviating from it. Dear Abby, I have been married for 4 years, and all this time we have lived in separate houses. Now my husband is finally moving in with me. While I'm excited, and it's going to be a significant financial benefit for both of us, I'm experiencing mixed emotions and a lot of anxiety about it. He's an awesome man who treats me great. This is a second marriage for both of us. Any advice would be appreciated. Making the leap in Florida. Dear Making, under the circumstances, your feelings are normal. This will be a big change for both of you. That is why it's important to talk about your feelings and expectations in advance, which might ease your stress. Being able to communicate honestly with each other is extremely important and will serve you well in the future. With this move, you are opening up a new chapter in your lives, and I wish you many years of happiness together. Dear Abby, 5 years ago, when my wife and I were 35 years old, she agreed to be on a team with me and compete in some adventure races. It was great fun. We had team T-shirts, trained together, and were excited about our results. It brought us closer and created a real sense of camaraderie, adventure, and mutual support into our marriage. During one race, a bull broke into the race grounds and chased us. Shortly thereafter, my wife quit the team, and sadly, many of the ancillary benefits declined as well. She will no longer be on a team with me. What should I do? Benched in Georgia. Dear Benched, because this is an activity you enjoy, you should keep going. Because your wife has chosen to retire from adventure racing, you should recruit another partner or find some other activity you both could enjoy together. And that's no bull.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.